This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
To realize the position in which Moshe found himself, one has to just see things in their correct perspective. Firstly, I remember a friend of mine who came back from an expedition to the South Pole, where they were for a year, was describing to us the role played by what they called the group leader or the team leader, whatever it is, and that he has the authority of an absolute king down there, bearing in mind that once you're there you can't come back for some 9 months, even if you have a heart attack or whatever it is. There's just absolutely nothing they can do. You've got to sit out your 9 months there. You see no one but these dozen people for the whole year. It's white snow which can drive you mad in itself. You don't see a horizon. It's just white. He described it to me as you know, sort of feeling the inside of a ping pong ball. Just this one, only 12 of them. And how any little argument can escalate into a major confrontation between two people and could end up in a murder if it isn't handled correctly by the group leader, who has the authority, if necessary, to kill. Because obviously no lack of discipline could be tolerated in such a situation. And one realizes that Moshe Rabbeinu must have found himself in the same situation, just that much worse. But also in the Midbar, so it's not cold, it's not snow, it's sand. Make much of a difference. They're not 12 of them, they're 600,000 of them. They're not non-Jews, they're Jews. It's not only men, there are women there too, and children and old people. There has to be a system for ensuring order, for educating, for directing. And it seems clear that the weight fell fairly and squarely on the shoulders of Moshe Rabbeinu. And this is something he realized when he was asked to take the position, although it wasn't going to be 40 years when he was asked to take it, it was just going to be a few days. So he takes the job for a few days, it's extended into 40 years, he's already a man of 80 when he takes the job, he's already a retired gentleman. He wants to now take things easy and sit and learn. At 80 he's given a job like this, to direct, discipline, guide, lead, and be the absolute authority, the melech, of some 2 million people, who were, don't forget, in addition to all the other things I mentioned, have just got their freedom. Taken out of Mitzrayim into a big free world. And Moshe has his problems as the thing goes on, and one sees his original reluctance to do it is fortified right through the rest of the Torah. It comes up again and again where it says to the Ribbono Shel Olam, get them off my back, I don't want it. It happens again in the Sedra. They're eating mon, and it's all going very nicely. And all of a sudden they get tired of Mon, this time Moshe, Mibichurav. And Moshe, Yeshua bin Nun, one of the servants of Moshe, one of his youngsters, answered and he said, see, Yeshua is a servant of Moshe, he's the one who finally succeeded Moshe when we were discussing Shim, if you remember. Not Moshe's own sons, not his Talmidim, his servant. He's the one who succeeds him. Interesting. Adonai Moshe Klaim. He turns to Moshe and he says, my master Moshe, Klaim, get rid of them. Different shot into what that really means. Why get rid of them? But he says, get rid of them. One understands what's troubling Yeshua. Yeshua has watched Moshe go through this crisis that he's just got out of with the assistance of the 70 people, where he just feels it's getting too much. All Moshe needs now is a threat to his authority. At least the 70 people are appointed by him, and they have smita from him, and they've experienced Nebuah, but they've got it no longer, and he can control them, and he can direct them, and through that he can direct the whole people. So everything's okay, and Moshe stands on top, and he has 70 assistants. Now you've got two young men in the camp that have also reached the level of Nebuah. They've reached incredible heights of stature and leadership, or potential leadership. And Yeshua is worried that this is going to set Moshe, his teacher, back again, and that Moshe is again going to ask the Ribbono Shel Olam to relieve him of his position one way or another. Yeshua says, Adonai Moshe Klaim, get rid of them. You can't possibly tolerate this in the camp, that there should be any split leadership, that there should be anyone else challenging your leadership in the camp. What does Moshe say? Vayomer LaMoshe, and Moshe says to just imagine this old, tired Moshe, okay, giving of his strength. Don't forget, we have the picture of Moshe being very powerful and dynamic, And at the same time, we see a tired old man, and he's both. If you met Moshe at 5 o'clock in the morning, after he hadn't gone to bed yet, you wouldn't believe he was a tired old man. You would think he was a dynamic young man. But his wife and family probably knew that he was exactly a tired old man. That's the art of leadership. It requires that despite all these things which he discusses with the Ribbono Shel Olam, never once did the people feel this. So there you've got this, Yeshua must have known that Moshe was tired, worried about it, drained, finished as far as giving is concerned. There's this threat, he says, Adoni Moshe Klaim, get rid of them. And Moshe says, are you taking over now? Halavai, everybody should be like them. May they all be prophets. Ki yiten Hashem et rufa lehem. Ribbono Shel Olam should only give of his spirit to all the people. That's an incredible stature. At this point in his life, to feel totally unthreatened. Not at all. He's felt threatened by Korach. He's felt threatened by all the complaints and everything else. But not threatened by greatness. That's it. But the feeling that somebody else among the people might outstrip him in greatness, and the Bible says, it should only be my greatest pleasure. And the Mephoshim say, among other things, that he's not only saying that there's one thing if the Talmud outstrips the Rebbe in greatness. That's something that gives the Rebbe tremendous pleasure. That's something that where there is no jealousy in such a relationship, because the Rebbe feels in any case that whatever greatness the Talmud has achieved is through him in any case. So it's no insult, on the contrary. It's the biggest compliment that can ever be paid to a Rebbe. But the Mephoshim say that what he's saying over here is, even if it's without me, and that's what Yeshua's objection was. Yeshua, who's been a Talmud and the servant of Moshe for all these years, and has been sitting with him and working with him and working with him, he's not a Novi yet. He hasn't reached this level. Two outsiders, all of a sudden, are inspired and reached incredible heights, which nobody else except Moshe himself have reached before. And this is what worries Moshe, this is what worries Yeshua, that there are people in the camp who have reached greatness, but not through you. They're not even Talmidim of yours. You haven't brought them to that level of greatness. And this is what poses a threat to your leadership. None of your Talmidim becomes great, that's one thing. But that an outsider should become great and walk in, that poses a threat to your leadership. And he says, Adoni Moshe Klaim, get rid of them. Moshe says, Halabat. If only, I'm no threat, whatever. See that same quality a little bit further on in the Sefer too. Imagine tired old Moshe, who's had enough of it all, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, his own family, that's Daber Miriam the Aaron the Moshe. Miriam and Aaron start stinnering Moshe. His own the one place where he has support of his is with his brother and sister. That's the one area the people who understand him and know him and have given him constant support. All of a sudden, they start too. So imagine what he must have felt like. Any other person in this situation would have given up on the spot. Either died or got ill or committed suicide, who knows what. And he carries on. The Ribbono Shel Olam punishes her and gives her a tzaraat. And immediately, by Yitzhak, Moshe Hashem Lemor, God's busy shouting at the Ribbono Shel Olam, Kerel Nora, Kerel Nora, Ribbono Shel Olam, heal her. Absolutely no pleasure in the fact that she's being punished. Absolutely no hesitation in ensuring that he uses all the powers and all the force at his disposal to ensure that she's healed as quickly as possible. There's not the slightest question that he feels any veiled or hidden satisfaction in the punishment which Miriam receives, which is also great. Now, not only do we see a greatness of Moshe here, but we see a difference in quality between Moshe and Yeshua. And this difference becomes quite relevant as we go through the Torah from here onwards until the end of the Torah. Yeshua, the potential, the future successor of Moshe, and Moshe are different people. Yeshua feels the threat. Moshe doesn't. You know, in interpersonal relationships, we'll have to still talk quite a lot about what there has to be and how one develops it. But before that, one has to talk about and understand what the barriers to interpersonal relationships are. What is it that stops them? Because, carry on further from what I said last night, if you look around at this place in Medrash and you try and work out what's missing, and you try to put your finger on one element that it seems to be missing in everything, I want to try and find something which is common both to the Benod and the Matur and then the other and the Chavera between in our relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam and our relationship with one another. The element that seems to be each other, you don't feel that they love their wives, you don't feel that they love the Ribbono Shel Olam, you don't even feel they love themselves. Somehow. They're sort of cybernauts. They go, they work, but not even self-love. Selfishness, yes, but selfishness is not self-love. Self-love is that you admire yourself a little bit. You hold yourself up in esteem a little bit, at least. Destructive sometimes, but at least it's something that's not cybernautical. Because, as we discussed last night, the three different types of people, the dead person, the animal man, and the human man, as a human being, you can achieve all sorts of wonderful things. But an animal being, he's still alive. As long as you're alive, you're moving. You can do something. You're either moving up or you're moving down. But if you're moving down, you can reverse it. You can do something. Now, with a dead man, there's nothing you can do except for the separate tradition. There's nothing else you can do. And as I've always said, that experience and progress in Torah is very similar to flying. I learned a lot about Torah when I was learning to fly. As long as that propeller is moving, you're okay. You don't have to worry about anything. You can be diving down towards the ground, and until you hit the ground, you can still save yourself. No problem. There's nothing to worry about. As long as your engine's going, that engine stops, you're in trouble. And that's how it is with people. The plane can carry on a long time without the engine. It coasts. Goes on and on and on and on, and all of a sudden it falls out of the sky. And that's what happens with people as well. Their propeller stops, and they don't notice it. But they're coasting, they go on. But there's nothing you can do anymore. Except call the separate edition, work out where it's going to crash, and have the separate edition waiting. And when you're dealing with cybernauts as opposed to people, that's all you can do. Work out where they're going to crash ultimately, and just see that you're there to pick up the pieces and clear it out so it doesn't disturb anyone else. But with people, even if they break, you can change, you can move, you can feel, you can use intuition somehow to stimulate and to change direction until the person starts moving upward. The absence of ahava, absence of love, is something which is serious, but it depends why. We have to try and understand why that love is absent, whether it's really absent or it's covered up. I think I told you that at the hesped of a friend of mine, one of the things that was said was that he was a man that wasn't afraid to love. It was said by an important rabbi. When that was said, I spent a long time thinking about that concept. Firstly, it summed up the man that they were talking about to a T. That's exactly what he was. But it suddenly struck me that it is possible, not only possible to be afraid to love, but that the fact that they could pinpoint that as his special quality, he wasn't afraid to love, means that everybody else is. What is it that brings about a fear to love? And that's what I want to notice in the difference between the character of Yeshua and Moshe. The difference is one of love. Moshe says, why everybody should be like Eldad and Medad? You're talking about the same people. It's a machlokes between Yeshua and Moshe. They're both people of stature, both qualified to pass an opinion about the validity of people and their actions. You're talking about the same people. Yeshua says, get rid of them, and Moshe says, halavai, everybody should be like them. What's the difference? It's the same people. So tell me that a Rebbe talking about the same situation, they're applying the same intellectual standards, they're applying the same reasoning, halachic reasoning, because the one is a Talmud of another. These are two close people who've lived together and who've taught one another and who've built each other up and who see the world the same way, and yet a situation like this they see in diametrically different ways. What's different about it? Not the intellectual analysis of the situation. The intellectual analysis is identical. Except Moshe is not afraid to love them. and Yehoshua has to get rid of them because he can't handle them. The only way you can handle an Eldad and Medad is with love, and Yehoshua can't love them. We'll discuss why not. We mentioned a few weeks ago that if one feels inadequate because someone else is on a higher level than oneself, there are only two things to do. To pull them down, to talk Loshon Hara, to denigrate them, to do whatever you can to pull them down from that stature, or to love them. And it's one of the two. And if you don't have the capacity for love, you will pull them down. And that's really, when one looks around at this community and many other communities, at the strife that goes on, it's all this fear to love. It's a fear to open one's arms and see something and relate to it naturally and freely. And instead, it's immediately, one measures up, is it bigger than me or smaller than me? If it's bigger than me, it's a threat, so I must put it down. That's the way we reason. It's not the way one reasons if one loves. It's not the way a father reasons with a child. The child should get greater and greater and greater. The father doesn't see it as a threat. It's not the way a rebbe reasons with a talmid. It's the way people reason with one another somehow. He's a threat to me, therefore I must put him down. That's not the way Moshe reasons. And I think there can be two reasons for reasoning the way Yehoshua reasons. The first one is if one isn't a genuine person, one can't afford to love. Because love is an intimate relationship between any two human beings when it exists, and it's a revealing relationship. And if you're afraid that you're going to reveal something which doesn't quite live up to the image that you want the world to have of you, you just can't afford the luxury to love, that's all. It's going to be too humiliating for you to love. That is one of the big problems. It's not Yehoshua's problem, but in a sense it is, and I'll discuss that in a moment later. The second is, things also, put it this way, in loving you've got to give an awful lot. That's what loving is all about. If what you've got is quantitative, you also can't afford to love, because you're giving at your own expense. If what you've got is qualitative, you can afford to love. Right, it's like further on in Bamidbar, when Moshe gives Yehoshua Tzmicha, the Rebbeinu Shlomo says, give of your glory to Moshe, to Yehoshua. And one of the things we learn over there is that he gives glory from himself to Yehoshua, but it doesn't detract from himself. It's like lighting one candle from another. A person who thinks that by loving or by giving, you're going to be left with less, is a person who's living on a quantitative level. Yes, quantitatively it's funny. Quantitatively, the more you give, the less you've got. Qualitatively, the more you give, that's the difference between peace. That's the difference between government and chesed. That's the difference between chesed and self-centeredness. It's the difference between arrogance and anova, between arrogance and modesty. It's the difference between all these dualities that we've talked about in Torah. If you want to define whether an experience or an object is qualitative or quantitative, all you have to measure is the effects of giving it away. That's it. You know, you've heard often the story of people not wanting to have big families because how much love can you give? Difficult enough to love one child. Love two children. To love three children. But more than that, where do I get the capacity from? It doesn't work like that. If your love is quantitative, taka. The more children you've got, the less love you're left with. If your love is qualitative, it's kumfaket. It's exactly the opposite. The more you give, the more it generates, and it moves, and the dynamicism sets in, and it turns, and it churns out more and more and more. The less you give, it becomes solid, it solidifies, it gets clogged and blocked, and your whole mechanism stops working. And that's really our problem. It's because we either live quantitatively, or we think we live quantitatively, we don't give, and we get clogged up, we get blocked, and we can't give, and the whole thing cracks up. Now, to give, you've got to have a lot. You can't give from your capital, because then you get poor. Then you try to get poor. To give, whether it's emotionally or financially or whatever it is, for example, laws of tzedakah, not that you give from capital. Laws of tzedakah that you give from income. If you're living off of interest, then your tzedakah is calculated as 10% on your interest. If you're a working person, then your tzedakah is calculated on your salary, not your work. And so on. to be able to give interest, one has to have a lot of capital, and one has to invest that capital wisely to ensure that the interest is being generated. And that depends the nature of that interest or capital, we'll see in a moment. If the capital is material, yes, you're going to run out of capital, because the more you give, the less you're going to have. If the capital is spiritual, it's not going to be so. And here one simply has to look at what is it that's motivating. And we come back now to our two dual relationships and dual worlds in which we live. The world of values and the world of action. The world of the Ribbono Shel Olam, at one moment we relate in an intensely private relationship between God and us, and at the same moment we relate between us and the rest of the world. It's a relationship like this all the time, vertical and horizontal all the time. What is it that's motivating us? That's what's important. In both, what is the central motivating force? If the motivating force is the world of action relationships, is the material world in which we live, then we would have a material mechanism, and we're going to run out of giving. If the motivating force is the relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, it doesn't work like that at all. Let me give you examples. In the man-world relationship, one goes into business. The question is, what is motivating you to go into business? If you're going into business as an end in itself, to go into business, then you can't possibly afford any time off business. You've got to stop learning. You've got to devote yourself entirely to business. And any detraction or distraction from business is going to cost you. You're going to have to pay for it. It's going to be heavy. If you're going into business because you're motivated by your man-God relationship, that's a different thing altogether. Then you start off on the assumption that the Ribbono Shel Olam has set aside some money for you in any case. As long as you set about it the right way, you'll get it. And as long as you work assiduously and carefully and you follow the rules, you'll get it. You don't have to worry about it. And it wouldn't enter your mind to go to your work without davening before. And you understand, in fact, that there's a more direct connection between your earnings and your davening than there is between your earnings and your business. And your whole relationship is completely different. And your whole activity is completely different. And Mishulah comes into your business, you don't watch your watch. And you're giving generously because you don't see that he's come to take away from you. If your function in business is to make money, then your Mishulah is your enemy. He's come to take something away from you that you've worked for. If you're in your business because as part of a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, your Mishulah is your customer. He's come to give you business. He's come to give you a business which is going to enable you to give, has been able to justify your existence a little bit better, make you feel more alive, make you feel better, make you feel more comfortable. It's a completely different thing. So if you want to know how you function in business, then you must examine yourself after the Mishulah is been and gone. Has he been an expense? You put the amount you gave him on the debit side of your balance sheet on the credit side of your balance sheet. It's really simple. You say to yourself, that was a cheap mitzvah. Oh, it cost me 20 rand, and look what a mitzvah I had. Fantastic. This might be the best deal I've done today. And you say, 20 rand, how long did that take me doing? It's a completely different approach. But don't think it's an approach in business or in a man-God relationship. It's an approach to Ahava. It's an approach to love. Because if you can put that 20 rand in your credit balance, you can afford to love. Because you're not going to run out of another 20 rand. If you have to put that 20 rand in your debit balance, you just can't afford to love. You've got to start with yourself. You've got to hold back. You've got to hold it in. Because the whole world are enemies. They're all coming to get from you. That's it. The development, let me put it differently, just before I go on, to crystallize it, one sees here clearly the relationship between man-God mitzvahs and man-man mitzvahs. You cannot be a moral man unless you have a sound and intense relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because if you don't have that sound and intense relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, you can't afford to love. I don't say it has to be a religious relationship, whatever it is, but those people, religious or irreligious, who can afford to love and have the capacity to love and are not afraid to love, are people who have the spiritual relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Let's look at it slightly differently. If the thing that gives me the thrill in davening is that everybody else should see how frum I am, or that I should see myself how frum I am, or that I should convince myself that I'm frum. Well, I found some other reason. It might be the most sophisticated bit of philosophy that motivates me to go to davening. I might have worked out how it's in my interests and how it affects me this way and that way, but it's me, me, me. It's very nice, but that man, when he goes out of the davening, can't afford to love anybody, because everything is self-centered. And as much as his philosophy is sophisticated, and as much as he's worked out the dozens and dozens of fantastic sounding reasons why he's got a daven, as long as it's not motivated by a plain and simple Avat Hashem, I daven because it's the first thing I want to do in the morning is talk to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the whole night I've been away from him. First thing I want to do is thank him for waking me up so nicely, thanking him for the fact that I've got an income, a job, everything's good, everything's going nice, I'm feeling healthy. Before I go out, there's nothing more that I want to do but to thank the Ribbono Shel Olam. If that's not the way you daven, it's self-centered politics. Sophisticated, unsophisticated, it makes no difference. You're fooling yourself if you think that the more philosophy you wield into it, the more sublime it is. It's equally animalistic. See, the guy, he doesn't have it at all in a sense. Okay. We've often talked about the fact that you're davening, and at least it's educational value, and things can happen, etc., etc., but it's simply getting yourself into a routine and a rut of self-centeredness. And you know what kind of a rut it is? It's a rut like a record. It's not a rut that goes straight. It's a rut that goes round and around in an internal spiral, and eventually you switch yourself off. Okay. It's narrow and narrow. The only way one can avoid that is to ensure that the action is not one of a groove, not one of a rut, but is one that enables one to move upwards. Leonard told me that Rabbi Bullman said, could you put tzitzis on the corner of your garment? The corner in Torah that it refers to is kanaf. Kanaf also means a wing. And he said a wing is an interesting thing because a wing is a sign of security. The little birds nestle under the mother's wing and so on. And we talked about God hiding us and sheltering us in the wing of his, whatever it is. And a wing is also a method to soar upwards. And he said, for those who are insecure and who need it, so there's a crutch, it's a place to come and hide, it's okay. For those who are healthy, it's a kanaf, it's a wing that enables one to soar upwards. And we have the same thing here. The man-God relationship is a source of security to the sick and the inadequate and the egoistic. And it's an ability to soar upwards, it's an ability to fly to the man who's able to love, to the man who's not afraid of doing something just because he loves. The guy who has to work out a philosophy for everything he does is a politician. He'll only do something that suits him, and he's got to work out a reason to suit him. And I've discussed many times, and I still hold by this strongly, that love is that emotion which the psychologist will never be able to explain. And whatever they can explain, if they think they've explained love, they must know that that's not it. All they can do is they can say that's not love. Because the whole concept of love is an irrational motivation to do something despite the fact that it has no philosophical justification. That's what love is. That's the beauty of it. And what we're trying to do is by starting with our 2 feet on the ground and by starting with something rational and clearly thought out and philosophically correct, etc., etc., I want to start flapping these wings and getting out and start moving into areas of that fourth dimension. The third dimension, the dimension of height. Now the difference between Moshe and Yahushua is that Moshe got his mitzvah from who? The concept of Moshe, if one were to look at Moshe as a concept, is a man who is motivated directly by the Ribbono Shel Olam. There's no interference, there's no intermediary, there's nothing secondary. He's motivated by nothing but that burning bush. That first confrontation with the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's what's kept him going all the time, and that's what continues to keep him going. Yeshua got smicha from Moshe. Now this doesn't mean, well, in one sense, yes, nobody will ever be like Moshe. Nobody's ever going to have that lead that Moshe had. Yet, I've always said that the various characters of the Tanakh, as well as the various concepts of the Tanakh, even if they don't apply to us directly, each one has a principle which is there for us. If the Ribbono Shel Olam has highlighted this difference between Yeshua and Moshe, it's for us to strive to be like Moshe. It's not for us to say, well, Moshe, we can't be like, so to settle for being like Yeshua. It's not like that at all. Although, on the broad sense, we have to be like Yeshua, and we start off at that disadvantage, Nevertheless, we can strive to reach the heights of the Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Gemara actually says, Zakenim Shibatar Dor Amru, the elders of that generation, the generation of Moshe and Aaron, the people who saw Moshe and Yeshua, the people who saw them both. By the way, this is a Sifri which is brought in Pinchas, and it's also Gemara and Baba Basra that I have. The Gemara says those elders used to say, Pnei Moshe ki Pnei Chama, Pnei Yehoshua ki Pnei Levana. The face of Moshe was like the face of the sun, and the face of Yehoshua was like the face of the moon. And the Kleiotis is a beautiful thing here. He says, the moon was the one who said in gracious, if you remember. You know, the Gemara asks, the Medrash asks, how is it that it starts off by saying God created the two big lights, and then it says he put the big light for the day and the smaller light for the night. The Midrash says they were the same, they were both big lights. So the Midrash, God actually diminished the power of the moon. Because the moon complained, and Shnei Malachim Malachim B'Kesev Echad. So the moon, two kings can't share the throne. Can't share a crown. That's it. It's either the sun or I. We're not working together. So the Midrash said, okay, then it'll be the sun. And he made the moon merely a reflection of the sun. Which is really what Yeshua is saying. The Kleiotis connects this up with that Gemara, and says, after all, Yeshua is saying, you can't have elders and maidens in the camp, two kings can't handle over here, certainly not three kings, let's get rid of them. Moshe says, no, I can handle them. The essential difference between the sun and the moon, firstly, the moon is a bit fake. Right? The moon looks like a source of light and it's not. That's part of its romance. That's part of a very special element that we admire of the moon. Ability to make itself look better than it is. That's something that we have to be able to do as well. We've talked about this often, the importance of presentation, the importance of making a thing look good and look in a sense even better than it is. The fact that we do it with food and we do it with clothing, we do it with anything that we want to sell, anything that we want to make look attractive, we make it look a little bit better than it really is. So there are aspects of the moon that we admire, but if you look at it carefully, the moon is a little bit of a fact. It's an ordinary old piece of rock that spins around the earth. And it makes itself look very beautiful, and it shines, and all sorts of things. It gives light in the night, and we're very grateful. You know, the people of Selma, I think it was, used to say that the moon is much greater than the sun. The sun gives light in the daytime, and nobody needs it. The moon gives light in the night. And that's really part of the way that the moon fills us. And it's that take, in a sense, which makes the moon unable to share the platform with the sun. I don't know whether before the moon was diminished, whether it was actually a 100% reflection of the sun. In other words, it was still a reflection, but the reflection was 100%, nothing was lost, and therefore we had as much light in the night as we had in the daytime, or whether it was a source of light on its own. I would imagine it was always a reflection, otherwise there would have been two suns. There seems to be an inherent difference between the sun and the moon. And I would imagine the pshat in the Medrash is that the moon was always a reflection, but it was a better reflection. There's something else interesting about the moon. The moon was diminished. So really, the effectiveness of the moon depends on the degree to which its surface is polished. It's a mirror. And the more polished the surface is, the more light it could give, up to the point of being 100% of the sun. It can never give more than the sun. And it can only give as much of the sun if it's put in good order. The sun is working full blast, at full potential, burning away there with all its might. Again, the moon can't really afford to love, because if it opens itself up too widely, people will find out that it's not really what it looks like, that it's not operating at full potential. The sun's better after all, it's only a reflection of the sun, it depends totally on the sun. It's a complete lack of independence. Whereas the sun is working at full potential, and can't be improved. The sun is either working or it isn't. It's either burning or it isn't burning. If it's burning, it's going. That's it. The moon is self-conscious in a sense. The moon is the kind that one would expect to look in the mirror in the daytime. And we're not watching, one would expect the moon to sort of be polishing itself up. And it's got to try and improve itself and get a little bit better. Which again is one of the aspects that we admire of the moon, the striving to get bigger. And that's part of the concept of Rosh Chodesh and Kiddush Levana, that we identify with the moon's efforts to get itself big, and then it falls again, and it's smaller, and it has to start all over again. And we're the same. You know, Shabbos, we work through a Shabbos, 10 minutes of Shabbos, we feel good on top of the world, and then we fall again, and it takes us a whole week to get us back up again, and we identify with this aspect of the moon. But the sun is totally unselfconscious. The sun is totally involved in burning. It's involved in producing energy. It gets on with the job. It doesn't have to stop and look back. It doesn't strive. It moves. It goes. That's it. And this really is the difference between Moshe and Yoshua. Yoshua on a level which we can't really identify with. Because what I've done basically is reduced Yoshua down to our level. Yoshua was of incredible stature. But somehow he's a quantity man. He's a quantity man, firstly, because he gets his ruchnius, he gets his spirituality from Moshe, not directly from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Whatever Moshe has of spirituality, in the most spiritual sense it can possibly be, because he got it from God himself. That's the definition of spirituality. Yeshua, it's already words, he's been taught, it's already the physical embodiment of the spiritual ideas which have been given to him. He's more of a quantity man. And in terms of a quantity man, he sees a threat. As somebody, or he sees other people as a threat to himself, in the sense that anybody else on his level could diminish his quantity. In fact, the Malbim says in Pinchas chapter Tazayin that Moshe had to give some of his Hod to Yoshua. And Hod is glory, and Hadar is also glory. And the Malbim discusses the difference between Hod and Hadar, and he says Hadar is external glory and Hod is internal glory. I would say that he means that Hod is the glory of the man-God relationship, the spiritual sort of glory, and Hadar is a glory in the physical world, an ability to handle the world well. And Yoshua was in fact a man of war, he was a politician, he was a leader in that sense, and Moshe was much more of a teacher, of a spiritual man. We talked about also last year his move from Gavra to Chetzer, he became more and more of a Chetzer, and so on. Moshe's Hod lay in the area of the man-God relationship. And he brings, in fact, Chazal would say that Yoshua didn't have the Hod of Moshe, because if he did, nobody could stand in his face. He was totally destroyed by just seeing him. He was so magnificent externally, but if he also had the internal personality and character of Moshe Rabbeinu, you wouldn't stand a chance. He would destroy the world. And Moshe likewise. Moshe didn't have the physical ability, and physical stature that Yoshua had. So we see two different people here. The man who's made it to the top quantitatively, and only later on tries to introduce the quality, and you've got the man who starts on the quality right from the beginning. This poses a problem altogether in the kind of lives that we live. Firstly, on the question of the fake, as a person becomes frum or becomes religious, he faces that problem every day. It's not really only a person who's becoming religious, it's anybody who's progressing. Because you constantly have to take on a little bit more externally than you're really worth internally, otherwise you never move anywhere. You've got to take on a new aspect of a mitzvah, or a new mitzvah that you're not quite ready for. And then you build yourself up into that. Then you take on another one, and you build yourself up into it. It's like the use of the hands when you're climbing. You've got to, you can't just jump from A to B. You've got to stretch your hand up and get a grip and then pull the rest of yourself up afterwards. And the physical mitzvahs are the mechanisms that the Torah uses to enable us to pull ourselves up. A person who's maintaining the same level in terms of the physical external mitzvahs is maintaining the same level internally as well. There's no way you can grow just internally by meditating or something. That doesn't work. You've got to grow by action, by doing something. And one needs to pressurize oneself into feeling more by doing more. But the moment you've done that, the moment you've stretched to the next step, before you've pulled the rest of yourself up to that level, you face a problem of faith. And that to me is the one problem that we face in the religious community. And it's caused by two things. The first thing it's caused by is by jumping up too many levels, which is not the case, I don't think, here. If a person jumps really to the point where he's totally unconnected internally with what he's doing externally, he doesn't want that ever exposed. He looks very frum and he looks very religious, and that's the image he's portraying, and he can't afford to love, because if he loves, he lays himself open and people find out who he really is. The other thing that can cause it is an artificiality in doing it. That is almost an embarrassment in the fact that you're doing it, and in the fact that you're not there internally yet. And if one sees this again, if it's motivated by philosophy, yes, you're going to have that embarrassment because there's no philosophical justification for it. For doing something which is above your internal level, how are you going to justify that philosophically? So you feel embarrassed. So you feel self-centered and self-conscious. So you don't, you close yourself off to other people so that they shouldn't find out. But if it's out of love of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that you're just striving so as to get a little bit nearer, okay, you're not quite there yet, then it's feeling embarrassed about. It's the normal situation of loving, of trying to do a little bit more than you're really capable of doing. That's the greatest thing that can possibly be. On the contrary, it's a source of pride, it's a demonstration of your love. There's no reason to be embarrassed and to hide anything back, as long as it's just a little bit above you, not too much above you. So the essence of it seems to be the fact that our motivation and spiritual progress is not one of ava, one of self-centeredness, of one form or another. And the other area is the essence of it all, which is the fact that we're not receiving from the Ribbono Shel Olam. Let me tell you how I think we can receive from the Ribbono Shel Olam rather than do it Yehoshua's way. We discussed a little bit of it last week when I talked about the fact that words are no substitute for the feeling that is trying. Spirituality out of them, how do you get out of the groove? That's the problem that we're facing. The question of breaking out of the groove, breaking out of this disc and moving upwards. And to feeling something when one does it. In the davening, the question of understanding the words, number one, it's very difficult to, it can be done, but it's not easy to daven without knowing what you're doing. It requires a bit of that translation or getting hold of somebody to teach you to work out that the fact that you can tolerate, and that many of us who are doing this have been davening now probably for over a year, and are satisfied to carry on davening without understanding the words, means that we're in a groove. Means that we're in a rut, we're going around and around. Means that what we're getting out of the davening is not our spiritual warm relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, but it's, I don't know what it is. Because if it was that warm relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam, we wouldn't be able to tolerate not knowing what we're saying. So we would stay up all night for two or three nights in succession until we knew what we were saying. And the fact that we don't do that shows that that's not what it's all about. And so it is with all the other mitzvahs that we do. Somehow one has to, sure, master the technique of the mitzvah, but that's only in order that you don't have to concentrate on the technique anymore. We make a religion of technique. That's what we're doing. We're playing our scales all day and we're never getting onto a piece of music. The important thing to do is simply, sure, you've got to know how to make kiddush. You've got to know how to make kiddush so well that when you're making kiddush, you don't have to think about how to make kiddush. You're thinking about the warmth that you're putting into it. You're thinking about the feeling that you're putting into it. You think about what you're doing with this glass of wine and what you're doing with Shabbos. Of course, you've got to know how to daven, but the idea of knowing how to daven is that you know how to daven so well that you have to put no effort whatever into knowing how to daven. The effort goes into the feeling and into the warmth, etc., etc. And so it goes through with everything that we do. And to understand that it's that which is at the core of our interpersonal relationships. That if that isn't right, if the man-God relationship isn't right, there's no way that the interpersonal relationship can be right. Because if that isn't right, then the interpersonal relationships is a groove. Interpersonal relationships is really just something in politics. That's really it. One has to see the cross-connection between different areas of activity. I've shown you the main one. People like to separate this, the man-God and the moral, or whatever you call it, and the ritual. Two separate things. They're not. And you cannot have the model without the ritual, and you cannot have the ritual without the model. One does that with all sorts of things. And to give you an example of a physical, material, now example of a lack of love and caring is, there's a chair that's been broken here for 4 months, maybe 5 months. Now, people might think that the reason I or you or whatever it is don't do anything about it is either because we don't care about chairs or because it's not our function. It's not. It's because we don't care about people. It never struck us or bothered us that somebody might hurt themselves on that chair. There's a field in the Torah that you've got to remove it, an obstacle. If you see a stone in the road, you've got to move it. If you see a banana skin in the road, you've got to move it. Not because you care about banana skins or environment, because you care about people. And we live in such little compartments. But fixing a chair is a technical job that is done by people who care about chairs, people whose profession is chairs. It doesn't enter our mind that fixing or removing a chair that is broken is done by people who care about people. So it's each one, it's not our field. And that's one example of many, many, many. You just watch us interacting with one another. What you see is a total don't care. I really couldn't care. And one almost feels as if, you know, like Yeshua. With Yeshua, it's a little bit more than not caring. He's actually worried by the fact that that other guy is getting there further. He's getting there quicker. The concept of Ahavas Yisroel is something which has to transcend and break down barriers of politics and all sorts of other barriers. And I'm not talking about social interrelationship. Social interrelationship is something else altogether. It's the most superficial form of interrelationship altogether. And social relationship is not something you can or should force. Two people are friends and they get on well together, they go to a movie together, that's fine. I don't think that you must take you to a movie because you're learning together. That's furthest from my mind, but a question of caring. If one of us is going through a rough time, yes, maybe take him to a movie, not because of the social relationship. One of us is through. The guy needs it. And this kind of feeling is totally absent. This kind of being able to break barriers with ahava, to be able to break barriers with love, is missing because the love is missing. And it's not the love of people which is missing only. That, the reason that chair isn't fixed is because none of us love the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because if we love the Ribbono Shel Olam, it would be fixed. It shows a total stagnancy in our religious progress. The fact is, in this place of Medrash, there could be a chair that's broken for that long. It shows that we have got nowhere but nowhere. We're like little clowns that can do the tricks a little bit better than we could a year ago. But in terms of essence, in terms of essential requirements, nowhere. We're just the same as we always were. That's disappointing.